The need to address the Palestinian-Israeli conflict was a point that all the states unanimously approved.
If we could compel our husbands to make peace, we'll refrain from sex altogether.
Why is the President of the United States of America placing at risk the lives of tens of thousands of young American men and women for a war which has nothing to do with the 11th September?
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Monday, March 3rd, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. It's becoming increasingly more difficult to determine when the first Gulf War ended and whether the next one has already begun. Britain and the United States have all but fired the first shots of the second Gulf War by dramatically extending the range of targets in the so-called no-fly zones over Iraq to soften up the country for an Allied ground invasion. As Baghdad threatened to stop destroying its Samud 2 missiles if the U.S. presses ahead with its invasion plans, Allied pilots have attacked surface-to-surface missile systems and are understood to have hit multiple launch rockets. Targets hit in recent days include the Ababil 100, a Soviet-designed surface-to-air missile system adapted to hit targets on the ground, and the Astros 2 ground rocket launcher with a range of up to 56 miles. These would be used to defend Iraq in the event of an invasion or to attack U.S. and allied troops stationed in Kuwait. Britain and the U.S. insist publicly that the rules for enforcing the no-fly zones over the north and south of Iraq have not changed, that pilots only open fire if they are targeted. But privately, defense officials admit that there's been an aggressive upping of the ante in recent weeks to weaken Iraqi defenses ahead of a ground invasion. Analysts confirm there has been an intensification of what is known as the undeclared war. The Allied action will prompt allegations that Britain and the U.S. have unilaterally changed the rules of the no-fly zones. These zones are established, or rather were established, after the last Gulf War to protect Shias in the south of Iraq and the Kurds in the north. The Bush administration is pulling no punches in its quest to gain international support from the United Nations Security Council vote to use military force against Iraq. Someone leaked a high-level U.S. security document from the National Security Agency to the London Observer newspaper over the weekend, revealing a spying campaign the Bush administration is reportedly conducting against members of the Security Council. Martin Bright is a senior journalist with the Observer. Earlier today on Peace Watch, he discussed the details of the memo.
Yes, essentially it's details of what's called an intelligence surge, which is intelligence shorthand for an upping of the ante gathering of intelligence. And what it was doing was attempting to identify members of the United Nations Security Council that the U.S. government needs to come on board in order to wage war on Iraq, and identify intelligence from them, attempt to find out what their voting intentions were, and also try and find out who else they were having negotiations with.
Now, how were they going about gathering this intelligence? There's intelligence, and then there's deep intelligence, I would imagine, where you have something, you have bugging of phones, and then you have photographing of people, and I don't know. Why don't you describe to us the details?
Well, I mean, your National Security Agency has a specific purpose, which is very similar to an organization that we have in Britain called GCHQ, where it's all to do with signals intelligence, which in ordinary people's terms means simply that. It's the gathering of electronic information from people's emails. It's the gathering of telephone tapping information, and it's the interception of communications between two other parties. It's a massive worldwide operation that's going on all the time. The point about our story is that although we know very well that this is going on at the UN, various UN delegations have told us this, it's understood by most of the delegates there that everything they say is being monitored by other countries. The point is you're not supposed to get caught. And what our story showed was that unfortunately, the National Security Agency had slipped up and they got caught.
Mm. And so you're saying this is business as usual, really, in this arena?
Yes, business as usual in the sense of surveillance operations going on all the time. What is not usual is that someone, either within the NSA itself or within a sympathetic agency somewhere else in the world, has seen fit to leak this document, and that is extremely unusual. That is not business as usual.
Mm-hmm.
These things are incredibly closely guarded, and for someone to have decided to get this information out to the press suggests that someone somewhere, either within the NSA itself or within a fellow organization in another country, is extremely unhappy with the way things are proceeding with the war in Iraq.
Did your investigation, have you done any investigation around receiving these documents? Do you have any idea who might have provided this? As you've just suggested, it must be someone with a high level of clearance and access to this intelligence information.
We have some idea of where this came from. It is an anonymous source. I think one has to draw one's own conclusions from the content of the email itself. This was an email that was not only internally distributed, but it was going out to foreign intelligence agencies across Europe, asking for collaboration, asking for them to help. And it seems to us that our source must have been someone who was unhappy with that collaboration going ahead. But I must say, I must emphasize that that is a conclusion we've drawn from the evidence rather than something that we know for sure.
And so that was my next question. What evidence do you have that really helps you and your newspaper to feel as though this is authentic?
Okay. It's always extremely difficult with intelligence information, and other journalists will tell you it's even more difficult when documents come to you in the form of emails, because emails have no physical substance. They're simply on the internet, and until you print them out, they have no physical substance at all. So verifying emails, any emails, even an email from one's close family, is extremely difficult. And what you do with an email from a member of your close family, of course, is you at some point you may say, "Oh, thanks very much for your email," and they say, "That's okay." Now, with emails that are coming from within the intelligence service, that's a kind of confirmation that you will never get. The National Security Agency is never going to confirm the existence of such a thing.
But how do you know it's not a hoax then?
So what you have to do is you have to look at the internal evidence within the email, and you have to look at the sender and who it came from. Now, before any of this happened, we had no idea of the existence of a man called Frank Kozer at the head of a particular part of the NSA, and we now have confirmed that indeed he is the person he purported to be when this email was sent out, and we have also independently confirmed via the intelligence community in Britain and intelligence experts within the United States that such an operation was ordered by Condoleezza Rice, and such an operation did go ahead. Now
you verified that Condoleezza Rice gave the orders for this to take place, this operation?
As far as we can, yes. I mean, as with all these, as with all such stories, it's not something that she is going to admit to. She has, as far as I know, when she's been challenged on this, it's not something she has denied either, nor indeed something she would be wise to deny, because one, again, might expect precisely this sort of operation to be ordered in just such a sensitive time. We believe this to be the case, and we printed such a suggestion in the Observer on Sunday, and we've had no comeback, and we've had no denials either about the veracity of the email or of the veracity of the information that Condoleezza Rice ordered such an operation.
Does this in any way affect the relevance and credibility of the UN, in your opinion?
I think it has a rather curious effect. I'll tell you why. The commonly held belief is that the United States doesn't care at all about what the UN does. On the kind of liberal left in Britain and the various marches that have been held across Europe, the idea is the Americans don't care about the UN, they will go to war anyway, and the UN will be allowed to wither on the vine. What this memo shows is quite the opposite, that that quite high in the American administration, they care very much about the UN. They care enough to devote resources, and one can only imagine extra resources, to the surveillance of these UN delegations in an attempt to find out what they're doing.
Martin Bright, senior journalist with the London Observer newspaper, which broke the story over the weekend titled, Revealed, U.S. Dirty Tricks to Win Vote on Iraq War. Under intense American pressure, Turkey's foreign minister indicated today that his government would ask Parliament to vote a second time on whether to allow American troops to use the country as a base for a military attack against Iraq. The minister, Yasser Yakis, spoke one day after lawmakers here rejected such a plan. After a marathon meeting of senior officials, Mr. Yakis said that his government would take a new resolution to Parliament later this week after the government completed an assessment of the first vote. But members of Parliament who voted against the resolution told Free Speech Radio News and Pacifica they doubt Prime Minister Abdullah Gül will submit a new request to Parliament for fear his government would collapse. From Ankara, Aaron Glantz has the story.
Jubilant celebrations on the streets of Ankara Saturday night. The news spreads throughout the streets of the Turkish capital. By the barest of margins, the Turkish parliament has said no to the United States. 60,000 U.S. troops and 250 warplanes will not be allowed to use Turkey as a launching pad for a war against Iraq. Activists from around the city descend on a statue in central Ankara dedicated to human rights. Few can believe the news. For weeks, the Bush administration and Turkish leader Recep Tayyip Erdogan have pressured the parliament to support the war. But when it came time to vote, the parliament sided with the Turkish people, more than 90% of whom oppose the war. Sami Evran addresses the crowd. The head of Turkey's public sector workers union played a key role in defeating the war resolution. The people have won, he says. And American imperialism has lost. The narrow no from the Turkish parliament came after a 100,000-strong demonstration in the Turkish capital. Every sector of society showed up to protest the war. Turkish nationalists and Kurdish separatists, Islamic fundamentalists and gays and lesbians, student activists and trade unionists. Seamus is a 14-year-old Kurdish boy from Istanbul. His entire family woke up at midnight and took a night bus to Ankara to protest the war.
It will destroy the brotherhood of nations. Americans, Arabs, Kurdish, Turkish, we all want to live in the same area. But a war will destroy us all. And 40% of Iraq is Kurdish, and when the war breaks out, it will be the most dangerous for the Kurdish people.
There's an air of happiness on the streets of Ankara today. A sense that something historic has been achieved. For years, Turks say, they have been pushed around by the great powers of the world, pushed into wars and economic packages they didn't want to accept. Some newspaper reports compare the parliament's vote against the war to Turkey's victorious war for independence in 1923. İdem Çubukçu is editor of the left-leaning daily newspaper Evensler.
Kürtler...
For the last 25, 30 years, there has been a continual loss for the people. No strike has ever got what they wanted. Kurds have always lost. Democracy has not gone one step forward. There has always been losses and losses and more losses. But at this rally, the slogan was, "Together we can stop this war." And we did. And people have regained their self-esteem and self-confidence. It's a huge chance.
The U.S. government hasn't given up on Turkey yet. Thousands of U.S. troops remain in international waters just off the Mediterranean coast, waiting to be deployed. Presidential spokesperson Ari Fleischer.
As a result of this vote, Turkey has gone back to look at it. we are doing this, and it's unclear as well what the ultimate outcome will be. But no matter what the ultimate outcome is, one thing is for certain, and that is if the President of the United States makes the determination that force must be used to disarm Saddam Hussein, whatever route is taken, the ultimate military mission will remain successful.
The Turkish parliament is set to meet again Tuesday, and it's possible the body could reverse course and greenlight Turkey's support for the war. At the same time, the parliament will have to formulate the country's budget without billions of dollars the Bush administration promised in exchange for a vote against Iraq. Some analysts speculate the deficit will push enough deputies into supporting the war for the measure to pass. But multiple parliamentarians told this reporter today that Prime Minister Abdullah Gül won't ask the parliament to vote on the war again. Gül is reportedly concerned that his party will be thrown from power if it supports the war in the face of such popular opposition. One of the groups that turned out in force this Saturday was Harbiş, the Turkish War Workers Union. Mehmet is with the Turkish Navy's Sea Command. He expresses an opinion popular on the Turkish street.
USA is a country of democracy and freedom, but American people be against Bush? Why did not they do anything against Bush if it is a country of democracy?
For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Aaron Glantz in the Turkish capital, Ankara.
A key al-Qaeda operative, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, was arrested over the weekend in Pakistan. He's described by the Bush administration as the man who masterminded the September 11th terrorist attacks. But Middle East correspondent Robert Fisk says there are a lot of unanswered questions.
Well, you know, we're about to go... No, let me get this better. You're about to go to war with Iraq.
Britain's not going?
No. I'm British, but my prime minister does not represent me. I think I'm represented, like most British people, by President Chirac or Chancellor Schroeder. Mr. Blair does not represent what most British people think. This may be the way it's represented on the New York Times or the LA Times or the Washington Post, but it's not true. The issues here are very straightforward. The Americans are going to war for issues which the British do not believe in. Mr. Blair says he does. Fine, that's up to him. We are told they're weapons of mass destruction, in which case we should perhaps invade North Korea. We're told that there are human rights abuses, in which case we can, you know, invade Saudi Arabia. I think that there are very good reasons for crushing the regime of Saddam Hussein, but we've had these reasons for 20 years. The issue is now, why is the President of the United States of America placing at risk the lives of tens of thousands of young American men and women for a war which has nothing to do with the 11th of September? We're getting closer and closer to this question, and it's still not being asked. So it's being asked in Europe up to a point, but not enough in America.
Well, can we talk a little bit about this alleged capture of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed?
Yeah, sure. Here's a guy who we know whose brother was involved in the first attempt to destroy the World Trade Center. We know, his uncle was. We know his brother was involved in an explosion which killed him, which probably was him trying to build a bomb. Here's a guy who's clearly involved in violent, cruel, executional action against the United States of America. But is he really the mastermind? It wasn't long ago we were being told that a guy in Germany, who had apparently been a friend of Mohammed Atta, was the mastermind. It's not that long ago that we were told that the victims of an execution by an American pilotless drone Predator aircraft were among the top 20 al-Qaeda leaders. Whether they were numbers 5, 6, 7, or 8, or 17, 18, 19, and 20, we were not told. But journalists, I'm sorry to say, your journalists didn't ask that question. And the real issue now is, are we really, really, really getting to the roots of al-Qaeda? Or are we, as I suspect, frankly, raising the issue that we are winning this war because we want to get away from Afghanistan, a vast national tragedy in which we are not interested in participating. Bush came to, you know, say, and Blair actually came to Kabul to say, we will not forget you, to Afghanistan. But Afghanistan today is an anarchy. You cannot travel the roads by night. The Germans who run the international peacekeeping force in Kabul talk of pulling out if they were under attack. The drugs barons are back, many of them paid by the Americans. And now we're being told, of all things, my God, now we're being told that the Americans are going to liberate Iraq and create democracy.
So, Robert Fisk, you do believe that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was captured, but you're not necessarily convinced that he is who they say he is.
I can tell you that a Pakistani police official made it clear to me that he was not certain he was captured. I think he may have been captured, but I don't believe he's been taken outside Pakistan for the CIA. Maybe he has. But, you know, we're living today in this gray, molding, dark world of propaganda. I don't know. But what I will say is, if he's the mastermind of September 11th, 2001, and he may be, how come we were told someone else was the mastermind a month ago, and that a few weeks before that we were told that some of the masterminds of Al-Qaeda were killed, as I'm sure they were, in Yemen by a pilotless drone aircraft? We are not being given details which are acceptable as reality. And one of the problems now is that journalists are becoming the fonctionnaires, the French would say, civil servants of authority, instead of saying, hold on a minute, you said this 2 weeks ago, you said this 3 weeks ago. Are you sure you mean this?
Middle East correspondent Robert Fisk. While the hunt for suspected terrorists continues abroad, it also continues here at home. In a case authorities say is tied to terrorism, a University of Idaho student from Saudi Arabia pled not guilty Thursday to 7 counts of lying to immigration officials and visa fraud. The FBI implied a connection between the arrest of the 34-year-old computer science doctoral student in Idaho and 3 other men arrested at the same time in Syracuse, New York area. Those 3 were charged with illegally sending $4 million in aid to Iraq through the charity Help the Needy. The Idaho indictment has some local attorneys suspecting a government witch hunt as the FBI and the INS continue their investigation in the university town of Moscow. Foreign students are fearful of what's to come. Lee Robartis reports from Moscow, Idaho.
100 FBI agents were in Moscow, Idaho for the arrest of Sami Omar al-Hussein at 4 a.m. last Wednesday. Al-Hussein was 2 months away from receiving his doctorate in computer science with an emphasis in security and intrusion. Authorities say he has ties to terrorism. Later Wednesday, the U.S. Attorney for Idaho, Thomas Moss, announced the grand jury indictment flanked by regional FBI and INS chiefs and local law enforcement.
In this case, we have 7 instances that we allege that visa fraud was committed because representations were made that we contend were not true.
Moss wasted no time tying the case to terrorism, calling into question $300,000 funneled through al-Hussein's 6 bank accounts to the Ann Arbor, Michigan-based Islamic Assembly of North America. Moss said al-Hussein also created or administered 14 websites for the IANA that contained numerous articles promoting terrorism. The indictment contains a single 8-line quote advocating suicide attacks that the FBI says was written by a radical Saudi sheikh.
This can be accomplished with the modern means of bombing or bringing down an airplane on an important location that will cause the enemy great losses. I might mention that this was published in June of 2001, less than 4 months before the terrorist attacks on 9/11.
The FBI searched the Islamic Assembly of North America offices in Michigan Wednesday, but did not make any arrests there. Moss said al-Hussein's arrest was made simultaneously with the arrests of 3 Arabs and searches at the charity Help the Needy near Syracuse, New York. Authorities accuse Help the Needy of funneling $4 million in aid to Iraq without a license. During last week's press conference, Idaho Governor Dirk Kempthorne was asked over a phone hookup if more arrests were expected, only to be shushed by James Chip Burris, the special agent in charge of the Salt Lake City FBI office.
I don't know if in that one question earlier, if you can make any comments about a close associate of Al Hussein and...
Keep him quiet.
Referencing as to his location at a particular time.
Governor, I think we'll leave that alone. It will probably come out maybe within a week.
Al Hussein's attorney, David Nevin, objected to the high-profile press conference, which included the president of the university saying he felt betrayed by Al Hussein's actions.
It's really appropriate for people who aren't directly involved in the case to butt out and not use it as a political opportunity to try to gain some political ground. It's completely inappropriate. It's inconsistent with the way our government is set up. It's inconsistent with the constitutional rights that apply, and it's really troubling.
In this case, Nevin feels the government has little to go on.
If there's not even an allegation in the indictment, as there's not, that Sami Al Hussein has ever so much as uttered a word in support of people engaging in violent acts, despite the fact that undoubtedly his life has been gone through with a fine-tooth comb. That may be meaningful. I think it probably is. I think it's probably because he didn't do that, didn't advocate that.
There are about 200 Muslim students at the two universities in the area, but few are speaking out now out of fear. In a written statement, Marwan Mossad, president of the University of Idaho Muslim Student Association, assured the public of Al Hussein's innocence. If anything, said Mossad, this man has always been a man of charity and peace. According to local ACLU attorney Elizabeth Brandt, the government tactic of having an INS agent asking questions while the FBI scribbled notes adds to the fear foreign students are feeling.
On Wednesday, they showed up very early in the morning, 6 a.m., a common thread that I heard was that the response would be, well, you've got 1 hour to get an attorney, and if you don't get one, you've got to answer our questions anyway. And of course, at 6 a.m. in the morning, for an international student to be able to obtain an attorney if they didn't already have one, you know, pretty impossible. They were being threatened if they didn't answer questions or permit broader searches of their homes, like of their hard drives on their computer, with deportation, immediate arrest for deportation for failing to cooperate with an INS agent.
Brandt says so far, 25 mostly Saudi foreign students have been questioned, and it's rumored that the larger Muslim student community at Washington State University, 8 miles away in Pullman, has been targeted as well.
I think that it's a witch hunt.
Cynthia Miller is the local attorney representing Sami Al Hussein's wife, Maha. Miller says her client was interrogated for 5 hours without being notified of her rights. She says agents took advantage of her poor English.
It appears that the FBI seems to be using this raid that was brought into Moscow and Pullman and the situation with Mr. Al Hussein to, in my opinion, rally support or trying to create a situation that supports a much bigger picture with the pending war on Iraq and what's going on worldwide.
Indeed, Al Hussein may represent one of the Bush administration's few hopes of tying support for Al-Qaeda with support for Iraq. Meanwhile, reaction among students varies. Seth Novak says most fellow students assume Al Hussein is guilty.
Somebody had a friend that was his neighbor, and they said, and he never even knew, like, you know, like they just automatically took it to be a truth, which kind of disturbs me.
Jaime Yanez, a Peruvian who is president of the Iberian and Latin Student Association at the University of Idaho, says the level of fear among foreign students depends on where they're from.
Some people is kind of scared, especially the people that is closer to the Middle East. They are like, what is going to happen with them? If there is going to be some reaction against them.
Yanez says even Latin American students wonder if there's going to be more regulations and changes in visa rules in the future. Al-Hussein is being held in Boise until a detention hearing March 11th. The U.S. Attorney's Office is moving swiftly, asking for a trial date of April 15th. Al-Hussein faces 25 years for each count of visa fraud. For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Lee Robartis in Moscow, Idaho.
You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.